Welcome. This is Sherilyn Parsons, founder and director of the Bay Area Book Festival. Enjoy the conversation.
Welcome to the Bay Area Book Festival's program on the Parish Review. I was in this room for the previous session on Barry Lopez, and thousands of cell phones went off. So if you could please just double-check, triple-check that the cell phones are silent, that would be wonderful. The plan is we will talk amongst ourselves for a time and then open up to some questions at the end for the last 15 minutes or so. My name is Christian Kiefer. I'm currently serving as the West Coast editor for the Parish Review. I am very honored to be here today with the magazine's newest editor, Emily Nemens, and a group of writers who have been published recently in the magazine. I'm going to go through some introductions really quick, and then we will immediately begin a discussion. Does that sound good to you? Okay. Starting down here at the end, Franny Choi is a queer Korean-American poet, playwright, teacher, and organizer. She is the author of two poetry collections, Soft Science, which I have here, which is amazing, and Floating Brilliant Gone, and the best ever titled chapbook, Death by Sex Machine. She has received awards from the Poetry Foundation and the Helen Zell Writers Program and fellowships from the Vermont Studio Center and the Rhode Island State Council on the Arts. Her poems have appeared in Poetry Magazine, American Poetry Review, The Parish Review, and New England Review, and her work has been featured by The Huffington Post, Ms. Magazine, PBS NewsHour, and Angry Asian Man. Aside from writing and teaching, Franny is a senior news editor for Hyphen Magazine and hosts the Poetry Foundation podcast, Verses, along with fellow poet Dennis Smith, which is a great podcast that you should subscribe to. A member of the Dark Noise Collective, Franny is currently a postgraduate fellow at the University of Michigan's Helen Zell Writers Program and a citywide poets site leader at the Detroit School of Arts. Franny Choi. Okay. Kiese Lehman. Lehman, as you say in your... Yeah, I know. As your hated teacher said, Kiese Lehman is the author of the novel Long Division and the essay collection How to Slowly Kill Yourselves and Others in America. His most recent book, Heavy, an American Memoir, was winner of the Andrew Carnegie Medal, the LA Times Isherwood Prize for Autobiographical Prose, Audible's Audiobook of the Year, and was named one of the best books of 2018 by the undefeated New York Times, Publishers Weekly, NPR, Broadly, Library Journal, The Washington Post, Southern Living, Entertainment Weekly, and the San Francisco Chronicle. Damn. Kiese has written essays, stories, and reviews for numerous publications, including Esquire, McSweeney's, The New York Times, Virginia Quarterly Review, ESPN, The Magazine, Granta, Cutterlines, NPR, Lit Hub, The Los Angeles Times, and many others. He is currently the Ottilie Schillig Professor of English and Creative Writing at the University of Mississippi, Kiese Lehman. R.O. Kwan, Reese Kwan, is the author of the nationally best-selling The Incendiaries, a novel named Best Book of the Year by over 40 publications. The Incendiaries was a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle John Leonard Award for Best First Book, Los Angeles Times First Book Prize, and Northern California Independent Booksellers Association Fiction Prize. Her writing has appeared in the New York Times, The Guardian, The Paris Review, BuzzFeed, NPR Selected Shorts, and elsewhere. She has received fellowships and awards from institutions, including the National Endowment for the Arts, Yaddo, McDowell, the Breadloaf Writers Conference, and the Sewanee Writers Conference. Reese Kwan. And directly next to me, Emily Nemens is a true polymath of the arts world. As an illustrator, she has collaborated with Harvey Pekar and others and has had a cartoon in The New Yorker. How many people can say that in here? As a writer, her short fiction has been featured in N+1, Esquire, The Gettysburg Review, The Iowa Review, and Blackbird, and her debut novel, The Cactus League, is forthcoming in 2020. She has received scholarships to attend the Disquiet International Literary Program in Lisbon, the Sewanee Writers Conference, and Tent Creative Writing at the Yiddish Book Center, and has had residencies at the Herman Hermitage Artist Retreat, the Kerouac Project of Orlando, and Denniston Hill. She co-edited the Southern Review for 7 years before being named editor of the Paris Review in April 2018. In my opinion, she brings to the magazine fresh energy and a clear vision forward into a more inclusive and interesting literary future. Emily Nemens. So let me tell you briefly, when I first came to the magazine, and then I'll introduce the magazine, and then I'm going to be quiet for a little while. When I was a boy growing up in Auburn, California, east of here, a town that I still live in, small town, kind of artsy, but no real art infrastructure. We had one bookstore that sold, like, How to Be a Buddhist books. And there was no coffee shop. There was no place to hang out. There was a movie theater that showed blockbuster movies. Like, I saw E.T., I think, 80 times one summer. But I knew I wanted to be in the arts, and I was really interested in art and didn't really know what to do. I got a scholarship to go to the University of Southern California to study film, largely because my teenage job was working at a video store, and I therefore saw every single thing on VHS and Betamax tape that came out. So when I went to USC, it was to become Ingmar Bergman. Unbeknownst to me, the film industry is an industry, and there's lots of people involved and lots of money, and I had no interest in money or commerce in any way. I was too pretentious for that. That's how I stumbled into my first fiction writing workshop. The teacher was this tall, lanky, Willy Wonka-looking dude. He introduced himself as Tom. He wrote under the name T. Caragazan Boyle, T.C. Boyle. I had no idea who he was. Of course, I researched him, read a bunch of his books. He was publishing in Playboy and Esquire and, like, glossy magazines. I asked him, "Hey, Tom, if I wanted to sort of avail myself of what's happening in literature, what should I read?" And he gave me a bunch of recommendations, and he said in passing, "Oh, and my friend George has a magazine. You might want to check it out. It's called the Paris Review." And I said, no, I don't really care about literature in France. I mean, here. And he said, "Just trust me." So I didn't have any money, so I went and did what students do. I went and stole a copy from the USC bookstore. And that was the first time I really even heard the names Dennis Johnson, Laurie Moore, Patricia Smith, Calvino. I mean, these were all the people that I was reading in 1990, 91, and I hadn't even heard of these people before. So, of course, I told Tom, like, "Hey, your friend George has a pretty rad magazine." And there was sort of no turning back. I felt like a door had been opened into a world that I didn't even know existed. And it's been, full steam ahead ever since for me. The magazine was founded in 1953 by Doc Humes, Peter Matheson, and George Plimpton. William Styron wrote a famously snarky introduction to the first issue. In its first 5 years, the magazine published Jack Kerouac, Philip Larkin, V.S. Naipaul, Philip Roth's Goodbye Columbus, Adrian Rich, Italo Calvino, Samuel Beckett, and Nadine Gordimer, to name but a few. Its Writers at Work series debuted in that first issue with an interview with E.M. Forrester and continued to offer long-form format where deep discussions of art and literature and life could appear. The series has since included Toni Morrison, Joan Didion, James Baldwin, Alice Munro, Carlos Fuentes, Lydia Davis, Don DeLillo, Salman Rushdie, Maya Angelou, Marilyn Robinson, to name but a few of the hundreds of interviews the magazine has published. In 1973, the Paris Review moved to New York, with George Plimpton continuing as editor until his death in 2003. Emily Nemens, as I said, joined the magazine in April 2018 as the seventh editor to take the helm. In a profile soon after the position was announced, Vanity Fair noted that the editorship of the Paris Review remains one of the most respected positions in American letters, and one that comes with a weighty legacy. And I'd just like to start by asking Emily if she'd say something about stepping into such a position and what an editorship like this means.
Sure. Well, thank you for that kind introduction, Christian. I want to say just a few words about Christian. Obviously, he's been a huge fan of the magazine, and that energy and passion has been a huge help. We did not have a West Coast editor before last summer. I'm very interested in the magazine keeping its New York roots in that community, but really expanding to a national audience, national readership, but also national writers, as demonstrated by the group of folks on the stage with us this afternoon. So it's been a great joy to work together. Thank you. And he has a new book out that he's not spoken about, but Phantoms is very lovely. It's a great, great book. So in terms of what it meant to step into those shoes, to sit down at that desk, of course it was intimidating, but the 7 years I was at the Southern Review, which was founded by Robert Penn Warren and Kenneth Brooks, when they were similarly young and ambitious in the 30s, they were two, I think, 31-year-olds. So, and understanding the literary legacy and stewardship and respecting that, but also updating a magazine into the 21st century and contemporary publishing was something that I'd done before, that I like doing, that I understand. Of course, every publication is different, and the nuances of what needs to get held on to, what needs to get pushed forward, is a different equation with each publication, but it's a problem I like to solve for. And so when I sat down, that's the first thing I thought of, is what is true and exciting and dynamic and contemporary about the magazine, and how can I make that more so, and what do I need to sort of push forward? And central to our DNA is, of course, the interview series, and continuing that apace. I have to say that is probably the most of the stewardship part of my job. The Paris Review interviews has been, it was a hack on a certain level before there were hacks, and I mean that in the best way of, here were a group of young editors that wanted to feature exciting, dynamic, brand new writing from young authors, but elevate that by adjacency to the most established authors of the day. And so by approaching very well-established authors and asking for a retrospective interview, a collaborative interview, not a gotcha, but a document, a taste document, essentially, that could be an improved version of a conversation and have that live as part of the archive and the conversation into and become canonical on a certain level. We got buy-in, the magazine got buy-in from the very beginning from several generations of authors at once. And I think that adjacency is one of the things that makes the magazine so exciting. That being said, to have a collaborative interview that is often across several sessions, often across several months, sometimes across several years, the Frank Bedard interview that will be forthcoming in summer, I think the sessions were recorded in 2017, they were edited in 2018, and it's been 5 months of line editing. And we got it down from 90,000 words of transcription down to about an 8,000 word feature. And
did you say 90?
90,000.
90,000. What? How do we even approach that?
I mean, Garth Greenwell, who conducted the interview, approached it first. It's different with everyone, and that stewardship. You know, I had on my desk a list of interviews in progress, and some of them had just been assigned but not conducted. Some of them had been conducted but not edited. Some of them were just pie-in-the-sky ideas of wouldn't it be great. So part of being the new editor is, and part of having started my editorial career, I started my professional career in New York, working at the Metropolitan Museum, but then my editorial career really began in Louisiana at the Southern Review. So introducing myself to these, the interviewers and the interviewees, and seeing where things were, being nice but a little bit bossy about helping things along. And every relationship, every assignment is a different solution. In some cases, I have to edit the raw transcripts. Sometimes I get a rough cut and sort of finesse it into a more streamlined and dynamic shape. It really just depends on the three people working together on it.
Right. Franny, your poem is in the current issue, which was guest poetry edited by Monica Yoon. Am I saying Monica Yoon correctly?
I think so.
I think I am.
I say it.
She wrote a brief introduction on her appointment, which begins, poetry was last spotted wandering in the wilderness, asking itself the question, why am I? My original question was just going to stop there. What is poetry doing these days from your perspective, and how does a magazine like the Paris Review fit into what's happening? All my questions are like this, you guys.
Just defending the thing that I spend all of my waking hours doing. I don't know if I really agree that poetry was last spotted wandering around in the woods asking itself, why am I? I mean, I think that poetry was probably last spotted like welcoming a wedding into the world, or like being double tapped on a timeline, or like shared with like on a stage. I mean, the last time I saw poetry before coming here today was the Utah State Youth Poetry Slam Championship, where like eight teams of high school students from across the state of Utah, a state where I, as the featured poet, was given the note that Utah has a zero tolerance policy for sex education, and so you are not allowed to say anything that could be construed as sex education. So I was like, well...
Did you just throw your book away?
Yeah, I was like, my chapbook has the word sex in it. Not sure why I'm here, but here are my poems, kids. You know, in a state like that has like this, like a lot of the students talked about the epidemic of youth suicide, and you know, like that's where poetry is happening right now, is in this space where young people are gathering in rooms to talk about the things that they are, quote, not allowed to talk about in so many of the spaces in their lives. I think that there's this, it's a weird thing to have to kind of like have this perennial conversation of like, is poetry relevant? Has poetry died? And like specifically, I think veiled in that question is like, oh no, the people of color have poetry now. Has it died? You know? And that question is so, for that to be the context in which it's constantly brought up is like deeply perplexing and disturbing. Not perplexing, like we know what it is, right? But it's like deeply disturbing to me. But I don't know. I mean, I guess that I think that poems are at the table, in the room every time something like wild and like earth-shattering is happening. You know, like the wedding and the funeral are one examples of like the ways it's there when we like usher life into and out of this world. And so I don't think it's ever going to stop being relevant. You know what I mean?
I agree. Yeah. Do you happen to have the poem that we published with you? Would you mind reading it?
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, I could read it from there, or I printed it out in the business center of the hotel that I was staying at yesterday.
So. I have it right here, too.
Everyone's
has it. Actually, every single person in the audience also has it.
So this is I can read it. Here's the thing. It's a contrapuntal, which means that it happens in, it's in two columns, and so you can read it vertically or horizontally. Which means that if I read it both of those ways, it'll take a while, but I guess I'll do it. Okay,
please.
Cool. It's called Amid Rising Tensions on the Korean Peninsula. The idea was sort of that these two parallel stanzas or columns would sort of be, in you know, at least sort of representing the parallel universes of the Koreas, of the two Koreas. So I'll read the two things together, down and then across. One, your country's memory is short, but know this, we live, have been living, with this threat staining the earth we still call home to mark what happened. The choices made in the dry mouths of children, sown straight into our breasts. We live, have to live somewhere. Why not smother doubt to save the family we're responsible for? The only sunlight is this story, spun from the records, and we've taken its name as our own. Yes, we sob and shudder, yes, and feed our babies, and cling to them as if we're the bad ones for dear, stupid life, too. We can still hear the planes, their death knell hum, circling our heads like we were carrion despite the pictures, which know only how to tell one truth at a time. Our names were napalm, ravaged patties, lung cancer. Names, like ghosts, reverberate. The bad memories in the body, they climb to the surface from war's muck. War, the only surname on our unmarked graves. Our sustenance amid your savage freeze. So we married fear, salvaged these small lives. We're free, at least, to remember the acrid clouds we dripped from and cling to them as if we're the bad ones for dear, stupid life. Now I'll read it across. Your country's memory is short, but know this. We can still hear the planes, their death knell hum. We live, have been living, with this threat circling our heads like we were carrion, staining the earth we still call home despite the pictures, which know only how to mark what happened, the choices to tell one truth at a time. Our names were made in the dry mouths of children, napalm, ravaged patties, lung cancer, names sewn straight into our breasts. We live, like ghosts, reverberate. The bad memories have to live somewhere. Why not in the body? They climb to the surface, smother doubt to save the family from war's muck. War, the only surname we're responsible for, the only sunlight on our unmarked graves. Our sustenance is this story, spun from the records amid your savage freeze. So we married fear, and we've taken its name as our own. Yes, we salvaged these small lives. We're free, at least, to sob and shudder, yes, and feed our babies. Remember the acrid clouds we dripped from and cling to them as if we are the bad ones for dear, stupid life.
Emily, do you remember that poem coming across your desk?
I do. And it was remarkable. Franny, I took a peek into the interview that's getting published later this month, and I know that this piece is something, it's a new project, and it's the first thing you've published from a new project after your book, and there's such vulnerability in that, I think. I'm projecting, but how does it feel now that it's out in the world, I guess, and also how has the affirmation and the experience of putting something out, seeing how, I mean, structurally, thematically, it's such an incredible poem. How has that helped the project along?
Oh gosh, I mean, it's a little hard for me to think about really the next project. I mean, I think I know that this is tied in thematically to what's happening. There's no way to know at this point whether it'll stay in whatever, enters the world. But it's been, I think that the contrapuntal is kind of a flex, right? Like, it's kind of like a technical flex to be like, look what I can do. And I think that was sort of, I put a picture of it on social media, and that was sort of like the responses that I saw were that it was like, oh, like look at what this poet was able to do. And I think that maybe there's a part of me that wants to immediately react to that by being like, poetry isn't where you show up to like just show off your skills. Like, it should be like meaningful, and because it's like changing you on. And I think that's true, but I also think that there's also something affirming about flexing on people. As a person who grew up helping my parents navigate the world using the English that I had and my ability, my like control over English, like that is how like my family was able to move through the world in the ways that it did. And, growing up seeing my mom, be like shat upon by store employees for not speaking English that well. So to me, being able to show someone like I can write like an empathetic poem about North Koreans and about North Korea, with a form that is technically difficult, and that will make you say, wow, I can't believe she was able to do that. Like, that feels like a reclamation of more than just like hooray, I got a poem published in a magazine that I deeply respect. Like, all of that, and also there's this other element.
Great. I will also note, we had to go exactly back to the drawing board to figure out how to typeset this.
Oh, yeah.
So thank you for making us flex a little bit. I was just like, how am I going to fit this beautiful poem on between our margins? So it's a little bit small. We had to shrink the typeface just a tip.
Love it. I'm small. So.
Yeah.
Reese, the audience here might primarily think of you as a novelist due to your amazing debut novel, The Incendiaries, but you've published an astounding amount of nonfiction over the past couple of years, probably at least a book's worth, I think, of essays in all kinds of places, including On Being a Woman in America While Trying to Avoid Being Assaulted, which came out in January on the Paris Review Daily. And then just in March, a piece in the New York Times, Stop Calling Asian Women Adorable. Both of which were incredible and were the talk of the interwebs, and still are. Your nonfiction work often asks readers to reevaluate their positions in relation to gender, race, and power. And I wondered if you might speak to those concerns in your work.
Thank you for saying that. And yeah, thank you. That means a lot to me. So I very much think of myself as primarily a fiction writer, as a novelist. But what I realized along the way, and I started writing sort of more political nonfiction, I think started like the day after the elections. I was just so angry and I was so sad and I didn't know what to do with it. Like, it was such an immediate anger that it didn't work with my novel, with my fiction writing, which is, I was at a residency at the time, an artist residency. It was day 3 that I'd gotten there, and then the elections happened, and like I was just like sobbing at the dinner table. Like, it was just like that kind of among strangers, trying to apologize for, but they were sobbing too, so it was fine. It was just a sob fest. But so that was when I started writing more about sort of about political things, essays that have proven to be controversial every now and then. And I think what I realized is that I've been thinking about activism and what it is that we can give and what my strengths are. And so I was like, yes, I do want to. It is important to me that I donate. It is important to me that I call senators. I call them all the time. But I can perhaps have more of an effect. I can have more of an impact if I use my words, in print in some way, because that's a thing I can do. I can put words in an order that will maybe move people. And I realized that I was able to write about things that, that helped people feel as though they saw something of their own experiences in what I was saying in a very immediate way. And so I've just kept doing it. And I keep swearing I won't write another one. I need to focus on my novel. But then I get mad about something all over again. And then again, I don't know what to do with that rage. And I'm just like, okay, I guess I'll write about it. And this essay that came out with the Paris Review, that came about because it was just like, after the Kavanaugh hearings, I just started noticing for like a week. I just started keeping a list of everything I do just on a daily basis, on like a chill day, to try to avoid being assaulted. And they were such mundane things just like built into my life, you know, like look into the car before I get in, take a certain route home, lift if it's after a certain hour, even though my subway station is 15 minutes away because the streets are really dark and after 9 p.m. or so, I don't feel good. And there have been violent rapes in the neighborhood. So I just like, and the list just got longer and longer, and I got madder and madder, and I was like, oh no, I have to write about this.
Are you thinking in terms of a book, maybe? A nonfiction book, I mean?
Literally did not until you said that.
I'm telling you right now, I must have this book. Emily, could you talk a little bit about the relationship of the Daily to the print magazine?
Absolutely. So we publish the quarterly, 4 times a year. It wasn't don't do the math quite with 228 and 66 years, because there were a few years early on when getting manuscripts up to Holland to get printed took a little bit longer. But we're generally a quarterly, and I would not classify Styron's introduction as snarky, but it was very clear that this is a project of new literature.
Well, he's snarky about being edited, is what I mean.
Yes, well, that part, yeah. So really thinking about fiction, poetry, and essays. We published a part of Heavy in last summer's magazine, but recognizing that we live in the internet age, and that as much as the print object of the quarterly is something I said earlier this week to someone I had just met, that they would have to pull the print quarterly out of my cold dead hands. Like, I just really very much care about print and the object. That's not the only way people read, and that's not the only way people think about culture, and that's not the only way we want to operate in the world as a publication, as an organization that cares about literature. And so the Daily has been an evolving force since it began. You know, it was sort of, it's grown up with the internet. If you go back to the earliest blog posts, they were very chatty. They were generally, our web editor at the time sat down and said some things about some stuff that had happened to him or that had happened in literature. And it's evolved over the years, and our current web editor, Nadja Spiegelman, has this really great view and vision of how we can produce content online that complements what we're doing in the quarterly. And what that means is where we're really thinking primarily about new literature in print, we can feature exciting essays and interviews with emerging writers online. When we're thinking about pieces of fiction in print, we can ask for those fiction contributors to contribute complimentary either conversations about how that piece came to be or expansions of their thinking online. And so building out regular content, it's all free. It's generally 3 times a day, 5 days a week, so 15 posts a week that are one part regular features. We unlock several pieces from the archive every week so that even if you're not a subscriber, although everyone should be, you get a peek behind the paywall and get that regular feature of free content. But then also Poetry RX. I know, Franny, you've been featured as a poem to read for advice seekers. And but then also one-off or very resonant, meaningful essays that have a timeliness that we can't necessarily respond to in a quarterly publication.
And we have a conversation with Franny coming?
Yes.
Great. When's that going to hit? Do we know?
I think mid-May.
Okay. Great. Reese, do you have something to read that you could read?
Yeah.
That's great. Please, yeah, that's wonderful. I have it printed, but it cut off the last line. Do you have a better print?
Sure, I'll read from... I was going to read from my...
It gives you half a... See the bottom of the...
Yeah.
Wait, I have more of it. Here, this, that's the rest of it. I don't know why I'm doing this part of it with the microphone, but...
I will actually read from... You know, I printed this out, and then I found that it was actually more natural for me to read this from the phone because it was like I wrote it online, and then it was disseminated online, so it felt like it's more natural. Like
that's how we all read it.
Okay, so I'll read. I won't read the whole thing, just because it's a little long. I'll read the first part. On being a woman in America while trying to avoid being assaulted. Lately, I've come to suspect that maybe a lot of people, especially men, still have no idea what it's like to be a woman in America going about her life while trying and at times failing not to be assaulted. So, these past weeks, I've been observing myself. I, for instance, elect to walk on certain streets, not others. The elevator doors slide open and there's one man inside. I evaluate his size against mine, calculating how well I could fight him off if I had to. I check the backseat of my car before getting in, just to make sure no one's waiting there. I don't leave my drink unattended. When I have to use the bathroom, I take it with me. It's a multi-person bathroom. I take it into the stall. I lock my car as soon as I get in. Then I start driving pronto, no dallying. While I'm waiting at the bar to buy a drink, a man starts talking to me. I respond politely, if briefly. I hope to indicate, without provoking his ire, that I'm not interested. I get unsettling emails from a stranger, a man. I try to decide what's safest. If I should create a filter that directs all his missives to the trash, or if I should remain aware of what he's saying. I make the filter, then I delete it. I should be aware, I think. I park close to the gym. I get catcalled. I pretend I didn't hear him. It's after 9 at night, so I decide not to walk home alone from my subway stop, paying instead for a short Lyft ride. I make sure the license plate is correct before I get in. The bar bathroom's in the back through a dark hallway. I have to piss, but I decide I'll hold it. I'll wait until I get home. I stand at a distance from the subway tracks. A friend who works in public transit once told me women are more likely to be pushed than men. It's dark, and I park beneath the light. A stranger on social media sends me a direct message. Hey, beautiful. I ignore him. No, I block him. I walk through the parking lot with my keys out, bright points spiking between my fingers in case I need a weapon. Several years ago, after a serial rapist attacked a woman in my neighborhood, I enrolled in a 3-day self-defense class. The first thing I learned was that it might help if I walk fast, with a purposeful stride. I'll look less vulnerable. It's night, so I walk fast. I try to look purposeful. I don't make eye contact. I make fake phone calls while I walk to a party in the Mission, listening to old voicemails I've saved, the voices of people I love piping again like songs. The doorbell rings after sundown. I'm home alone, so I pretend I'm not there. I get catcalled. I glare, but I don't say anything. I'm traveling, and I realize I forgot to lock my hotel room door while I was gone for a few hours. I check the closets, the shower, to make sure no one's in there waiting. I see three people walking toward me. It's dark, and I think they're all men, so I tense up. I get out my phone. When I realize one's a woman, I relax, slipping the phone into my bag. I make so many more fake phone calls than real ones. I'm exhausted. I'm in a rage. While walking, I accidentally make eye contact, and I tell myself, look stern. Look frightening. Don't look so fucking afraid. Thank you.
I mean, it's probably surprising to no women in the audience, right? Just life. In life as vulnerable in a way that I never have to deal with in that way, right? Emily, can we talk a little bit about the art and the design and the way the magazine's put together?
Yeah.
You could say no.
No, we can.
and the books.
And the books. We have an art director who is a brilliant... she started her career as a cover designer and is well-read in the art world. And it's been really fun to collaborate with her. Particularly, I started my editorial and publishing career assisting an art director. And so as much as I care about commas and I'm thinking about literature, I'm also thinking about how it looks on a page. And so that's been really fun to think about how the design happens, how visual arts and literature can work together. Visual arts have been central to the magazine since the very beginning. Right now we actually have a viewing room up on David Zwirner's website about the Paris Review print series. We convinced all sorts of artists in the 60s to, and since then, to make limited edition prints for the Paris Review, including Warhol, Rauschenberg, Christo. It's this great set that were, they underwrote the magazine. You could buy a Warhol for $50, and those sold out quite quickly, but that tradition of collaboration with the visual arts has been there from the beginning, and it's great fun to sort of think, use that side of my brain as well to put together the quarterly, the spring issue, which features Ferlinghetti's interview. Also, it's the first time in in my knowledge that we've featured a ceramics artist, Francesco DiMatteo, on the cover, and we did a photo shoot. And, you know, I can't be too cavalier about my art budget, but we were able to figure out a way to... sculpture is amazing and dynamic, but is often photographed in a very flat, sort of against a white that comes across as gray. And I didn't want that. I wanted to have it be not just a great object, but a great cover and what that might look like. And so taking Francesca's work goes from functional vases all the way into crazy statuary, but recognizing and finding a set of her work that does still have the function and at least the holes, which suggests that they were vases. And
you have it on the floor there?
Yeah, I have it here. So
yeah,
yeah, so that's been a fun part of the project.
That was an artist that you, whose work you already knew?
No, I didn't. No. I mean, I knew that I wanted an ambitious young ceramicist, and Charlotte...
I mean, don't we all?
Yeah. Charlotte Strick and I sort of both set out looking around, and Charlotte brought Francesca to my attention.
Yeah. And then you brought some copies of the Paris Review books.
Mm-hmm.
The new one of which has just come out in the last couple weeks.
Yeah.
How do those come about?
So we digitized our whole archive. I think we have, I don't know, it's probably about 15 linear feet of issues at this point, and it's all online behind a paywall, and there's over 400 interviews between art of fiction, art of poetry, but also nonfiction editing. We had our first art of documentary with Wiseman last summer. So the aggregate is this amazing archive, but also 408 interviews times 8,000 words is not something you'd like to do on the screen. So thinking about Paris Review editions as a way to bring some of our favorites out of that archive, repackage them as a beautiful book and put them in a new and interesting context. In this case, the writers that work around the world, thinking about the international strain and trend in and effort in the magazine from the very beginning, of course, moving to Paris and engaging with Francophone literature from the start, but then also thinking about global Anglophone literature, literature and translation. It's always been a subset. It's not as well represented as I'd like, but it has been there from the beginning, and I think sort of the evolution of the conversations about literature and translation and writers working outside of the publishing centers of New York and London and sort of that those communities is really an interesting one.
I appreciate those books a lot because there's... You all subscribe to the Criterion Channel? So the Criterion Channel just rebooted, and while we were waiting for it to start, they would give us a movie a week to watch, and we couldn't pick it. It was just Criterion would just give us a movie, and we would watch it. Now that the Criterion Channel is all fully operational, I now have thousands of movies to pick from, and I don't watch anything because I just can't decide and I give up. The thing that these books do for me that I really appreciate is that they're curated, right? Here are the best interviews for this volume. It's also very teachable. And so I really like, and I like physically having it in my hand. I don't mind reading online, and I have a bazillion issues of the magazine, but I do like having them all together. I can pop it in my car and go. I wanted to get to Chiesa, but I also wanted to apologize to Reese briefly. I sounded flippant earlier when I said it's surprising to no one. And also, it also exposes my own white privilege. In my white male body, I have a lot less to fear. Chiesa's book, Heavy, writes a lot about what he has to fear in his own body. The magazine published World's Finest Chocolate in the summer 2018 issue. I have gone on record saying that it's one of my favorite pieces ever to appear in this magazine. I've returned to it again and again. The ending couple lines just stabbed me right in the chest. That essay came out a bit before the memoir came out, and in part the essay and the book chronicles the complicated relationship you've had with your mother. That character also appears in the essay, and also chronicles the relationship that you have with America itself. To quote you from the piece, "Follow directions they told me, be a grateful black American, I heard." And I wondered how this essay came to be and how it found its way into the review.
That's a great question.
Thank you.
Yeah. So, again, I'm not sure, I don't want to speak for anybody else up on this stage, but I am of a generation of black Southern writers who had a complicated relationship with the Paris Review, meaning I read a lot of stuff in there that inspired me, particularly the interviews with Morrison and Baldwin, literally shaped how I saw the world and not just wrote. But the Paris Review, for me and a lot of other people I know, embodied like this sort of white, wealthy juggernaut of literary establishment. And for a long time, the question for me from like 20 to 40 was like, did I want to fight that juggernaut and or be a part of it? And I think about what you said about flexing. And so for a lot of us, and myself specifically, I just didn't think that the Paris Review could hold my body or my body's flexing. And why did I think that? Because I tried to get shit in the Paris Review for 20 years and they said, we can't hold your flexing or your work. We don't want you. So when they reached out to me, and somebody from the Paris Review reached out to me like in 2013 to do an interview online, which was an amazing interview. And then when y'all reached out to me to ask me for a piece for the print journal last year, there was a part of me that was like, oh, now. Now you want me. And I'm from Mississippi. I don't eat meat, but I appreciate chitlins. And I don't know if anybody in this room really, I mean, my father up there, I know he know a lot about chitlins, but chitlins for us were like the part of the pig that, you know, a lot of our descendants had to eat. That was what was left over. So when Paris, if you asked me for something, I literally was like, am I going to give them some of my good shit? Or am I going to get him some of my chitlins? And the flex was to be like, I'm going to try to get him some of my chitlins, right? So we were finishing up editing Heavy at the time, and there were some sections that did not make the book. And PJ, my agent, was like, you got to give him the best, blah, 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 blah. And I didn't talk to him about this actually, but you know, I was like, nah, fam, it's personal. Like, I tried to give them the best for 20 years. You probably didn't want me to say this shit, but anyway, like, this is how I feel. This is how I feel. And so what I ended up doing was trying to make a prose poem literally out of the chitlins of Heavy. Like, I tried to make a prose poem out of the parts that did not make the book. And I think when I turned it in, I called it a prose poem. And I was like, surely they won't publish this shit. And then they were like, they said, can we send you edits? And a little bit, I'm like, what? Like, you want, you know, I just don't think that piece is great. You know, I'm not supposed to say this, but I feel confident enough in my work now to be like, I just didn't think that was a great piece.
It's okay, man. You can be wrong about your own work.
Yeah, I could be wrong, but I could be right too. You know what I'm saying? And it was just interesting to me that of all of the things that I've written, that's the piece that they published. And thankfully, some people read that and found some merit in the work. But I did not. So I'm thankful that y'all took my chitlins, put it out to the world, put my name on the front of the Paris Review, and some people now can be like KSA Lame. And my father is like KSA Lame. You know, we meet people today. He's like, you know, he's going to the Paris Review conversation. That means a lot to a lot of people, particularly parents. But then it gets complicated because then I remembered Emily. We met last summer. And then I was like, oh, that's not who I imagined the face of the Paris Review being, right? I didn't imagine that the face of the Paris Review could be your face, right? And your sensibility, because I had followed you for a while. So anyway, my relationship with the magazine, I guess, is a lot more complicated than other people up here. I could never imagine the Paris Review that I grew up reading holding the dynamic work of the folks up here on this stage, but it does now, right? And part of that work, I think, to make it continue to hold our flexings and our failures, because this is what I think white, cis, wealthy authors get to do, is they get to fail in these magazines, and people treat that shit as if it's not a failure, is... be honest sometimes about work that is not up to standards. I'm so thankful y'all published that work. It is by far not the best work I could have done at the time, and it's by far definitely not the best work that I've done. But because it has peer review seal on it, people think that it's better than it is before they even read it. That says a lot about me. It says a lot about us. I think it might say a little bit about Parish Review, but what I love about who y'all chose to have up on here seems to me to speak to a determined, specific charge to change where y'all have been. And y'all have been some great places, but y'all have also been a place that did not hold this, did not hold us, could not hold you talking about flexing. And so I just wanted to say one of the ways I wanted to flex is to give y'all some refuse. Have y'all put my name on the cover of the book and hopefully sell a few more copies of Heavy because of that. And that's what happened. So thank you.
This was the issue right before I started, and I had not heard any of that. But thank you. Thank you.
I hesitate now to ask, but would you read some of it, or would you rather read from Heavy? Because I have it.
I'll read from it.
Okay. It's interesting that you say it's the Chitlins, because it is all the themes of your book crammed into a very small space, which is what I find really dazzling about it.
All right.
I'm going to defend that piece forever.
Okay, yeah. Defend it, brother. Defend it. All right, so the piece is called World's Finest Chocolate. All right. Follow directions they told me. Be a grateful black American, I heard. I did not tell mama what happened until the next morning. Instead of walking to school alone, mama walked with me. Our Nova was out of gas, but she wanted to talk to my white teacher and my white principal. When we got to school, mama made me stand outside when she went into the building. She came outside to get me 20 minutes later. Mama never said I had to pledge allegiance to anything or anyone who refused to pledge allegiance to us. Just know, she said, that there will be consequences for doing what you know is right, and one day I will not be there to fight for you. I sat in my third grade desk that morning during the Pledge of Allegiance, fully expecting to get another wooden beating before being sent to the principal's office for a fiberglass one. My black classmates stood. They pledged allegiance to our state and our nation. They pledged allegiance to the Confederacy and to democracy. At recess, a few of my black classmates asked me if my mama said it was okay to sit down during the pledge or if I was getting two beatings at school and another beating at home. My mama said, I ain't got to stand up, I remember saying. Your mama cool, I remember hearing. Your mama cool. At the end of the day, my white teacher gave us a brown cardboard box of World's Finest Chocolate to sell for the quarterly fundraiser. There were 16 tightly wrapped bars and a small manila envelope in each box. Each bar cost $1. The name World's Finest Chocolate always made me laugh, not because I knew there was no way in the world that the World's Finest Chocolate only cost $1, but because our world was Jackson, and finest generally described juicy black bodies, and our world preferred the word candy to the word chocolate. While mama was the kind of black mama to threaten your white teachers and your white principal if they ever beat your black ass for sitting during the Pledge of Allegiance, and the kind of black mama to read The Three Little Pigs to you when you were way too old for bedtime stories, mama was not the kind of black mama to take your World's Finest Chocolate with her to work and sell it to her colleagues and her students who entered her office. But I, in the first grade, was the kind of son who ate every bar of World's Finest Chocolate and blamed the eating of every bar of World's Finest Chocolate on the mice in our house. And I, in second grade, was the kind of son who got sick from eating too much World's Finest Chocolate. And I, in first and second grade, was the kind of son who got beatings from mama for eating all the World's Finest Chocolate she paid for with eager checks that never seemed to stop bouncing. As soon as the bell rang, the day we got our World's Finest Chocolate, I took off out of Raines Elementary School with my backpack full of books and my left hand gripping the cardboard box. I could not wait to see mama. I wanted to thank her for helping me not get beaten by white folks with wooden and fiberglass paddles. On the way home, I felt faster than I'd ever felt, even with a box of more than 2 pounds of World's Finest Chocolate in my hands. I started crisscrossing between the pointed barriers on the left side of Flag Chapel Road, built to protect kids from oncoming cars. I lost my footing halfway down the hill and tumbled into one of those barriers. The sharp, rusted edges tore through my shirt, ripping a 6-inch gash across my stomach, and then it goes on. So. All
right. Thank you.
Thank you. Emily, would you like to comment on anything?
I still like the essay, even if it's your chitlins.
I think it's important, though, that was right before you got on.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, thank you. But I do, you were saying, you know, you wanted to get an audience for Heavy, and I think that is, I was actually looking at the mission statement that was written when we became a 501c3 about 18 years ago, and it was written down in 2003, I guess that's 15, but it's been central to the magazine from the very beginning is, you know, it's two-pronged. It's helping writers find audiences is the first thing, and supporting artistic careers, writers and designers. And the second part of that is the readers and thinking about bringing literature to new audiences and enhancing everyone's life through literature. I think that's particularly important when, you know, we're all thinking about the news a lot. I'm not going to say too much, but reminding people that there's a place in their life for poetry, that there's a place in their life for fiction, that there's a place in their life for essays, and taking a step back and thinking about a new, more nuanced conversation and an artistic interpretation of what's going on in the world around them. So finding writers whose books we're really excited about and featuring them just in advance of publication is an important piece of the puzzle for me. I mean, another important piece is finding writers who are looking for that first shot. I love it, and it's happened recently where I publish a piece and then the writer gets a book deal. And figuring out how to really elevate and advocate for people whose writing we care about and feels necessary.
What about the concerns of, like, Paris Review's long history of sort of, like, supporting a particular kind of white patriarchal writing since the 50s, and how you're addressing that as an editor new to the position in a new world filled with media?
Well, I think that our archive is our archive. Our publishing history is our publishing history. I think it's interesting and exciting to make anthologies and frame that literary history in different and dynamic ways. But, you know, every quarter every day on the daily, but every quarter in the magazine, we're reinventing what we do and why we're doing it in terms of the conversation of interviews that have been 2 years in the making, of fiction writers who are publishing their first or second or third piece, a group of poets. And I think that recognizing the generational conversation between poets, I think, Franny, it's really interesting that your poem was also in that same issue, where poems by John Ashbery that were, they were cleaning out his office and an incomplete suite of poems on the Cherney Variations were at the bottom of a box. And I feel like it's a real privilege and an opportunity that the magazine is big enough to hold all of that. It's big enough to hold Franny and John. And that together, that conversation is just much, for me, it's much more meaningful and exciting than one or the other.
We have about 13 minutes for questions at the end here, if there's any questions from the audience. We've covered it all. There's nothing to... There's one here. Okay. There's one here in the front. And please, if you're asking a question, make sure in your head there's a question mark at the end of it.
I was just looking at statistics on the chances of getting assaulted by a stranger, and it's less than 1%, less than half of 1%. I don't say that to diminish anything you've said. You know, less than half of 1% is insignificant until it happens to you. Well, the reason I mention this is because there is a category of women who are at a much higher risk of being assaulted by strangers, and that's poor women, any woman making less than $7,500 a year. So my question is, what can we do as artists to reach and ameliorate that level of violence Is there something we can do to make art more relevant to people that are not as privileged as all of us are?
I feel as though, did everybody hear the question? Mm-hmm. There's a lot in the question that I think I would disagree with. I think framing it as an either or inherently I would disagree with. Increasingly, the more I publish pieces that I'm glad to see people share them. I'm glad that people respond to them. But increasingly, I get stranger and stranger emails and direct messages that just show up for me. And I got so many messages from people who essentially said things like, I remember one woman, I actually tweeted this out because I was just like, what is happening? It was a man. He sent me a long message. So strongly recommending that women carry swords, because swords, if we carried swords, we would look immediately much less vulnerable. I don't think it's an either or. I also don't think, on the one hand, I feel very lucky to get to be a writer. I feel very lucky to have this life in which I get to grapple every day with what I care about, words and language, syllables, punctuation. I love that I can sit around and think about commas for hours on end. This is a great privilege. I wouldn't say that. I know so many artists who don't have healthcare. I know so many artists who don't come from privilege, who aren't. And so I don't think separating poor people from artists isn't necessarily an accurate dichotomy at all, especially in America. As for how to make art relevant to less privileged people, going along with what we've been talking about, I think it's so exciting to me that there are more and more people who are being published, who are being heard, who are making bestseller lists, who are winning prizes, who come from a variety of backgrounds. And that's clearly something that the Paris Review under Emily's stewardship is very interested in doing. It's also, with this makeup. I mean, Franny's Korean. I'm Korean. I've never been on a stage with a Korean poet before. I kind of stopped counting, but since my book came out, this is maybe like my 85th event or so. And I've never been on a stage with a Korean poet. That's wild to me. And that it wasn't framed as like Asian American voices. You know, it's just a Paris Review and we happen to both be Korean. I think that's so beautiful. And I think that the more there are voices from different kinds of backgrounds, the more there is for people to naturally be drawn to. Growing up, I had no Korean. I didn't read Koreans until after college. Until I graduated from college, I loved an art form in which I did not exist. I could not have existed in Tolstoy, in Wharton. I would have been like a circus freak if I were in Tolstoy's world. And so seeing that expansion, I think, is one of the best ways to, I don't know about making art relevant. That phrase always is not one I think I tend to run with. I think art is relevant, and the idea of making it relevant, I think there's so much relevance in specificity. I think there's so much excitement in specificity. There's life in specificity. I think the idea of universal appeal is in and of itself centering a straight, white, privileged male gaze. I don't know if other people have thoughts.
Can I say one thing? And I just want to say one of the things that I think that like we artists have to do is be more accurate in our description on the page. And because so much of what the art we do is like we interact. So like this is art, right? I'm artfully interacting with you right now. And I'm going to artfully describe what I just think you did. I just think that was a lazy bullshit comment you just made, bro. And it was lazy because you want to assume a privilege after you heard the actual essay that distinguished my presumed experience that you might have, that I might have, that we might have up here, and then mush that experience down into like, you're too privileged to talk about being assaulted. That's what you did. That's what you did. Doesn't have to be what you said. That's what you did. So as an artist, I'm just going to say I think that was lazy and I think that was bullshit. And I say that with all the kindness in the world.
Oh, I heard a few of you on earlier panels, and then today in this panel, you're speaking from such a place of honesty, and I wondered if you could just talk about the courage to be and integrity it takes to be so honest in your work and your writing and in speaking to us.
Is that question
for any one of you?
You mean you're asking in the work or like in conversations such as this?
Both, really in the work, but in the conversation as well.
You know, this is also like not an unfamiliar brand of question as well, right? Like, one time I was listed for... Okay, no. I'm going to say that part second. The first thing I'll say is that the only thing that any of us can really do is to try to be as honest as possible. That is like what art making is at its heart. And then everything else is about, you know, that's motive. And then everything else is technique. That's what I believe. And I say that as somebody whose work does not often get categorized into like the raw, honest drumbeat of humanity that I think to be super real, a lot of the work of people of color, and particularly a lot of the work of black artists, gets categorized into as being raw, honest, at the heart, like unfiltered. Right. I'm somebody whose work sometimes doesn't get categorized into that, because I'm sort of like seen as like, oh, like the one who's like writing about race, but like look how weird and avant-garde she's doing it, you know? But still at the end of the day, the only thing I can do is write about to try to write about the truth of my life. And that attempt at full honesty is what anything that might be categorized as strangeness or innovation comes from, is an attempt to get to that. Also, I am deeply disturbed by the way that... Okay, the thing I was going to say earlier was that there was this one time when it was a group of poets of color that were published in the Breakbeat anthology, put out by Haymarket Books. We were doing a reading, and the Facebook event, like written by the bookstore that was holding this reading, said something about these poets are like speaking from the heart, unfiltered, the raw energy of their, you know, whatever. And it was like, here's a person who has a PhD. Here's a person who like has graduated from one of the most prestigious MFA programs in the country. Like, here's a person that's been published in like X, Y, and Z journal. And like, here's a person who comes from a legacy of like avant-garde poetics and is like using that, you know, the poem of mine that was published in that anthology was one where I reordered the lyrics to a Lil Wayne song. And so that it was like, that's not my unfiltered, raw, honest truth. You know what I mean? Like, that's like really intentional, a technical intervention in like, with like found, received language. Like, that's not, you know? And so, I just like deeply question, the way that honesty gets brought up with like a higher frequency, in spaces where panels look like this panel that we're on. You know what I mean? But yeah, honesty rules.
I'm just getting all the hits.
Oh, okay. Hi. This is for the Paris Review editor people. I'm thinking about the earlier in the conversation you were talking about how legitimacy was given to newer artists by who was doing the interviews. And so I'm wondering if you think about that, who you would like to interview in the future that would maybe be on the other side of that legitimacy, either POC writers or poor writers or women writers, so things like that.
We have sort of two tracks of interviews. There are, on the daily, we're featuring new writers, people who are making debut collections, or we've interviewed you twice for two books that we just wanted to support and put forward. And so that is, I'm not going to say it's easy, but it's an active and sort of very...
It's a way to champion.
It's a way to champion, and we can be sort of in real time. In terms of the Writers at Work interview series, which is, you know, a retrospective look at the literary canon, it was started in 1953, so at that point, those writers had been publishing in the teens. Right now, I'm looking for that series at writers. I mean, in the case of Ferlinghetti, he started publishing in the 50s, but writers that really started their careers in the 70s and 80s, and that's a long trail. And that I have to be mindful that people who started careers that have a retrospective reach in terms of their publishing career, I can correct for that so much through selections and advocacy, but it's a complicated equation. We're conducting our first Writers at Work interview in Mandarin right now. I'm really excited to think about internationalism that way. I think that being new, being an advocate for a more a broader literary conversations means that writers who might not have agreed to the interview series in the past have agreed to do interviews now, which is exciting. And I think, like I said, often these interviews take several years to percolate, and so you might not see that in the very next issue, but I do think that that space will also be a more diverse conversation moving forward.
You know, so, I'm sorry to, like, interrupt here, but I guess there's a question inside the question that you asked, and I didn't, like, my intention wasn't just to, like, shut down a conversation, but there is a question inside your question that I am really interested in, and I feel like I was, like, sort of, like, reactive in the way that I wonder if we have time, like, if we could sort of talk about maybe, like, the thing that I would love to hear both of you all talk about is, like, the engagement with vulnerability in the craft of your work, and how vulnerability, and particularly, like, around engagement with painful topics, like, how that, like, what sort of relationship you need to have to like, a vulnerable look at your own life in order to, like, create your best work. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. I mean, is it vulnerable, or is it, or is it a decision to no longer be polite, in a sense? Vinita Blackbird, in the essay that we published in the Daily this week, says something to the effect of white people are more interested in politeness than in the truth of combating racism. And that really struck me as interesting, given recasting a certain desire maybe to not be polite as vulnerability instead. So I was just wondering if that helps frame.
I think for me, this is part of why I love fiction so much, and part of why I think I view it as my primary sort of art field, is because there's that scrim of it's fiction. So I can always just say, like, I made it up, and they'll be like, but it sounds like your whole life. And it's like, no, I made it up. It's fine. And I think this is something I've only realized in the past month. The principal narrator of my first novel is a white dude, a straight white dude. And it wasn't on purpose. I came to that, like, sort of roundabout way. I had artistic reasons for it. But I think in some ways that let me be even more honest, even more truthful about like things that were deeply painful to me, because I was sort of like filtering it through this guy who nobody would mistake for me. And I've noticed this because over and over people sort of mistake my experiences for the principal Asian woman's experiences. And it doesn't really bother me, because I'm always like, well, you know, like that's like the least me of the characters in a lot of ways.
this always makes my parents nervous. They're like, please stop telling people that you feel super comfortable with the cult leader and that you like really, really get that dude. but yeah, so there is that. With nonfiction, I do feel in some ways more vulnerable when I put it out. It's always so, I'm so anxious when like a piece is going to go live. Especially talking about race and gender. I mean, I read a piece for a magazine, about being bisexual. They asked me to do it. I want to do it. I feel honored to do it, but that's going to be wild, like having that out in the world. But I feel as though at some point with nonfiction, I decided I wanted to stop valorizing not being hurt. I wanted to stop moving through the world pretending that I was tough, pretending that things that had hurt me had not hurt me. And I think that's part of why, for me, with nonfiction, if I can write about that, I think that's what people seem to respond to, because I'm saying, look, this has affected me, and this is how I want to talk about my experiences with you. And I think without that vulnerability, the essays wouldn't feel as immediate to a lot of people.
And I just think also what's amazing is that, you know, Franny, like, I imagine you as the audience for what I write, and you and your crew, right? Like, and Dinez and them, like, I actually get lost in your work, in your words, and, like, what y'all are doing with voice. But what y'all have done is, I think, for a generation, that's sort of a generation, a group of people who's actually significantly older than you, you've kind of freed us up to talk to you. But I do think it's complicated, right? Because we still don't really own the means of distribution for the major, major publications in this country. So while I can say I wrote heavy partially to you, it's important to say that no one like you or your sensibility was my actual editor, was my actual publicist, is my actual publisher. So I think, though, with what you all have done, particularly with poetry, has freed up a lot of us essayists, and I would say fiction writers, too, to be, I guess, more vulnerable or more open. But I just think that, I think it's important for us to say, like, that vulnerability or openness is not pure, right? It's still tainted, and ultimately it is made product. It's made into a commodity. And that's the part of it that I'm not sure what to do with. But I thank you for the work you've done to make us see you as part of the audience that we know is out there doing this brave work, but also bravely listening to us. So thank you for that.
I'm getting a big time out. Signing outside. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast from the Bay Area Book Festival. For more information and podcasts, please go to www.baybookfest.org.